recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is basically when you want to download it and then hit play later on. Today we have a great show, as we have Allison Skinner and Peter Vogel on our show to talk about special masters in e-mediation. There's been a lot of discussion at advanced e-discovery conferences on how many litigants, despite the amendments in the federal rules in 2006, are still not addressing ESI in their cases. In fact, one recent study of Meet and Confer said that only about 30% of cases are addressing ESI. One possible reason can be lack of knowledge about e-discovery by litigators who figure they already know how to try cases. This show attempts to provide some solutions to deal with ESI lack of knowledge by bringing in e-discovery experts to assist with the case. So we've got Allison Skinner, who's of counsel with Sherratt and Permut, a law firm based in Birmingham, Alabama. Allison assists individuals and business clients in all forms of mediation at the trial and appellate levels. She's registered as a trial, appellate, and domestic mediator with the Alabama Center for Dispute Resolution. She's also the first attorney in Alabama to serve as a mediator or special master for e-discovery. And in addition, the University of Alabama School of Law has just hired Allison to serve as its first adjunct professor for a course to prepare law students for the growing number of cases that involve electronically stored information. Allison, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me, Carl.
And Peter Vogel is a trial partner in the Dallas office of Gardier Wynn Sewell LLP, where he's chair of the eDiscovery Group and co-chair of the technology industry team. Before practicing law, he worked as a computer programmer, received a master's in computer science, and taught graduate courses in information systems. Peter has had trials around the U.S. on computer performance disputes, misappropriation of trade secrets, copyright infringement, software patent infringement, and internet disputes. He's been involved with ESI for more than 30 years and has been appointed a special master in ESI and technology disputes for more than 20 years. For 12 years, he served as the founding chair of the Texas Supreme Court on Judicial Information Technology, which is responsible for helping automate the Texas court system and putting internet on the desktops of all 3,200 judges. Peter's taught courses in the law of e-commerce at SMU Dedman School of Law since 2000. Many of his topics are discussed on his blog at www.vogellitlawblog.com. Peter, also thank you for joining us on the show.
Thanks, Carl. Glad to be here.
It's our first pure Southeast United States show here. So
I don't think people in Texas consider us in the Southeast, but that's okay. People are fine about that.
And in Pittsburgh, I'm only considered in the Southeast if you're in New York. So, but anyway, first of all, Allison, and then Peter, why don't you start off by telling us how you first got involved with eDiscovery?
Well, as a litigator, I represented clients primarily in the automotive industry. And I got involved with electronic discovery probably back in the 90s. How I came across promoting the use of mediation for e-discovery disputes is because I actually mediated discovery in a matter for almost a week. So the two came naturally for me to combine when I became a full-time neutral.
Okay. And then Peter?
Well, actually, I guess I've been doing electronic discovery since I started practicing law, because my law practice, I have only exclusively limited it to representing buyers and sellers of computer technology. So I've been dealing with electronic discovery since the first piece of litigation I had more than 30 years ago. It just sort of, I guess the world has sort of caught up with the fact that, you know, this is in the middle of everything we do. I think Allison discovered a statistic the other day that just kind of hurts my head, that the current estimates are that there are over 210 billion emails sent every day, and in 2008 there were more than a trillion text messages. And so we're living in this age of information that is just mind-boggling, and it's now affecting the courts. And so now that we have to deal with electronic discovery, you know, I've been in the middle of it for a long time, but it's an exciting area to practice.
Well, let's jump in first, and we're going to talk about special masters first, and then e-mediation. And I did a podcast last year with Jonathan Redgrave on this, who wrote best publication I've seen on special masters with Judge Shindlin, entitled Special Masters in E-Discovery, the intersection of two recent revisions of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which is a Cardozo Law Review publication, Volume 30, Issue 2, from November 2008. Peter, why don't you recap what a special master is and what they do?
Well, let me start by complimenting Jonathan and Judge Shindlin on a great article. You know, Allison and I both think it really sets the tone, and somebody who doesn't know about special masters, this is one really excellent place to find out. You can read about it pretty easily. But generally, the special master's role, and I've been appointed special master in state and federal cases for more than 20 years, the role is one where there is a neutral individual who the court relies on to help with a specific task. And so what happens is, in some instances, which can really help in electronic discovery, is if there's a special master, the lawyers might not really need expert witnesses, and they can rely on the special master to assist them, depending on what the dispute's all about. But the master is an individual that can hold hearings, make recommendations, issue orders, and then the parties have an opportunity to challenge them, just like they do with a federal magistrate judge. They can challenge it to the district judge and have a hearing there. So they're not necessarily committed to it, but I find that when I'm a special master, oftentimes what happens is the parties learn more about the underlying technology that they didn't really understand when they got into the lawsuit.
Allison, what are the trends that you're seeing with the appointment of special masters?
Well, I think the trend is awareness. I think that the courts are crying out for some help, and they're recognizing that the procedure under Rule 53 allows for the appointment of special masters, and that special masters can serve as an extrajudicial resource to the courts in trying to manage the e-discovery and the disputes that are coming before the court. I'd like to join Peter in complimenting the Law Review article, because it succinctly describes the roles of a special master in four different ways. First, the special master can serve a facilitative role for the parties. It can also, the special master may also serve to oversee compliance of court orders or parties' agreements. The special master can also serve to adjudicate and make findings to recommend to the trial court, and also serve for the technical expertise and assistance. So I think the trend right now is getting awareness that there are extrajudicial resources and tools for litigants on how to navigate their e-discovery disputes.
But I think Allison made a very good point, Carl, and that is the underlying reason for this is that, unfortunately, the judges in our country are not technology savvy. Most of them, I guess virtually every single one, has a docket that is very complicated, dealing maybe, you know, on one day dealing with a murder case, and the next day maybe, you know, a real estate case. But you know, understanding electronically stored information is not what they do every day, and they don't understand information technology in general. And so the role, because this is what I find when I serve as a special master, is I can answer questions to the judge that they just don't have a clue on. And so I think one of the advantages is it allows the litigants the opportunity to argue whatever the technology issues are to someone who is capable of understanding, and also being in the posture of, my view is that I think it's important that the person who's a special master have a law degree and be a lawyer. I think that there's a benefit to that as well.
And you know, and I've noticed I host a group in Pittsburgh called Friends of eDiscovery, which is a local networking group of eDiscovery technologists, lawyers, and in-house attorneys, NIT people, and judges. And I have noticed a real interest, not just from the federal courts, but also the state courts, to at least send clerks to these meetings to try to learn more.
Well, you and I talked about earlier, there's a case many years ago, and for those of us who were in the copyright arena would remember this, but in the early 90s, Judge Keaton hired a computer science professor to be a special master in a case of Lotus versus Borland, and it was one of the very first cases interpreting the Copyright Act as it related to software. And the opinion that came out was more than 100 pages. But those of us who, that as an academic, since I've been teaching for many years, the academic world looked at this opinion and said, this just doesn't make any sense at all. And it was very confusing. And a few years later, I had a case where the expert witness was this special master who had helped Judge Keaton. And when I took his deposition, I learned that he had never read the Copyright Act, and he had never read a single case interpreting the Copyright Act. And it sort of explained why the opinion was sort of confusing. And so, you know, part of the job, I think, is that if someone is a special master, it really helps a lot if they understand procedure and evidence, and they have the ability to read lawsuit cases and be able to apply those to the work they provide the judge.
You know, this is everyone's biggest fear, is hiring someone to help that you hope knows the subject matter so that you can do your job, and they're there to aid as a crutch. But what if they're not appropriate? So what's your advice for finding a special master who's appropriate? I mean, where do you look? I asked Jonathan this. Jonathan Redgrave, who wrote that law review article, we were trying to figure out if you could go to the yellow pages under special, under S, special master. And we think it's a little more challenging than that.
It is very challenging.
It is. Carl, I think you've asked a very good question, because when I received my appointment, I tried to reach out to some other special masters in the country, and I had a difficult time identifying those persons who are qualified that held themselves out in this arena. But I think with more awareness and training and more appointments, we will be able to locate those resources. I think the Academy of Court-Appointed Masters is probably a good place to go for those who know the rules and who have served as special masters. Might be a good resource to start. I think you'll also find folks are going to look geographically for people, but we may have to get beyond that requirement and actually reach out across the country to find the right person. I'm aware of a suit in Mississippi where they were looking for a special master, and they needed someone with gaming experience, very finite skills with the technology background. So that posed a unique set of circumstances to find the right special master. I think that we'll face some challenges, but as litigants in the judiciary become aware that conflict resolution and those involved with it and e-discovery are needed, then we're going to see those folks, you know, rise to the occasion.
And I also, my experience has been oftentimes you have to reach out to another part of the country, because I just got a request from a judge recently to serve a special master, but I had a conflict. And I think you reduce the amount of conflict for the special master if the special master practices in another part of the country. And Allison and I have found that ourselves.
And Carl, I'd like to add on your previous question the role of the special master, where it can be a benefit both to the court and the parties, is you can have more, quote, real-time responsiveness to the party's needs in a case. So much of what we're doing with e-discovery is very timely, and with the courts being overburdened with their dockets, they can't always get to the party's needs and address them timely just because of their docket. But a special master can be available to the parties to address their needs in, real time.
No, and I think that's an important point, because I have a master appointment right now in federal court, and we had a hearing on a Thursday, and the following day I issued an order, and we had a hearing on Monday, and then I ordered the parties to give me proposed orders to respond to what the judge asked us to do, so that all the interested parties could give us what they proposed it ought to read like. And then we had a hearing 2 days later for 4 hours to go through the proposed orders. So by the time I offered it to the judge, we collapsed everything within 8 days from when the judge ordered us to come up with this, and we had two hearings, and it sped it up. And I don't think you can do that in federal court. Not many state courts either.
Okay, well, these are good points on special masters. Given the fact that we did a previous show as well, I wanted to jump into the e-mediation area, because that's something we haven't really talked about on ESI Bites before. And
well, we don't think anybody's ever talked about it before, so this is kind of, this is a first, really,
well,
as far as we know.
It's you know, I think it's good to throw ideas out there in this field, you know, as we try to figure it out. And so let's talk about that. And I guess that takes some of the positive lessons we've learned from special masters and the parties, but the parties themselves craft the use of the e-discovery experts. Allison, you want to start off by describing the process?
Well, I appreciate that, Carl. When I wrote a paper called The Role of Mediation for ESI Disputes, because it was natural from my own experiences, and I think what is most helpful to the parties in using the mediation process is to help them craft their discovery plan at the outset of the litigation. I would even suggest that in your scheduling orders, if a dispute arises, that there would be a provision that the parties would mediate it before they would seek the court's intervention. I think in looking at the mediation process, if litigants will look at it not as time-based like we are used to with mediation when we're trying to settle our cases, but issue-based, then you can have a mediator to come in and out during the discovery phase of the case and help them navigate some of those issues. So if you don't get on board with a mediator to help you craft your discovery plan, then you can use a mediator during the course of discovery for different issues.
I mean, basically, in e-discovery, what the federal rules did is try to front-load the case to try to get your arms around it, and so you're suggesting getting a mediator in there to help with that challenge and then let the parties go litigate.
Well, one of the big advantages to this, and this is state and federal, I think, is that this allows the mediator to have a confidential caucus with the IT people, the client, and the lawyer, and they can turn all the cards face up because they don't have to, they're not disclosing it to the other side. And it's a unique circumstance that if you're in a meet and confer, and you bring your IT people. IT people speak a different language. I mean, generally, since I am one, I don't mind saying this, that generally they're incapable of having meaningful relations with other humans. And so they don't do such a hot job at communicating, but they want to be helpful in this process. And that's not necessarily their job. Their job is to help educate the mediator about what information technology they have, where the backups are, what the design of the network are, maybe, or and where everything is located.
And Peter, if I could add on to that, being able to have a process that allows you to propose confidential compromises, I think is a real plus for litigants and a real helpful tool to have that confidentiality surrounding the process in mediation.
What would you say are there any risk present with using mediation? I mean, if it's not handled the right way, doesn't it just add another layer of people involved touching it? Or,
well, here's what I tell people, Carl. One of the risks is when you create a discovery plan through mediation. I have asserted that the mediator's report is the discovery plan. Well, now you have come to some party agreements and what you said you were going to do and when you said you were going to do it. And if you can't meet those agreements, then now the opposing party has a document, you know, to go to the court and seek relief. So I think if there's a risk, it's that, yes, you have come to the table and you have made some agreements. And if you can't meet those, then the other side has a clear way of seeking the court's intervention.
But, I mean, historically, from the standpoint, I mean, I can't identify the specific case, but I do remember a few years ago that in a Rule 16 conference with a judge, one of the parties said, we believe it'll cost, let's say, $100,000 to produce this, and we think it's unreasonable. The other side ought to pay for it, you know, with the shifting burden cost events. And the judge said, no, I want you to pay for it. And it turns out it cost $500,000 or something, because the consultants underestimated the scope of the discovery. And so I could see something like that getting kind of complicated in this as well. But you have that risk all the time anyway. You have that under the federal rules.
Yeah, I mean, the whole area is filled with risks. And, you know, one of the concerns I can see right away, and I think you touched on it right there a little bit, Peter, is getting someone that really doesn't know the area that well as your mediator. And, you know, you have lots of mediators out there who've been trained in mediation, but one of the complaints you hear in e-discovery is there's a shortage of good e-discovery experts. Now you're
right.
Trying to blend the two together, I do think there might be some risk there.
Well, but I think that you've just made a really critical point there, and that is that an e-mediation will really only be successful if the mediator really understands electronic discovery. I mean, I think it goes the wrong way if you have somebody that doesn't.
Allison, do you think maybe, I mean, people have been talking about special masters for a while, and there is a movement. There's some courses being taught in that area. Sedona's offering some courses. But might there be a movement that takes the special masters and say, rather than be court appointed, why don't we look for a special master to mediate?
Oh, I completely agree with you, Carl. In the Sedona Conference's Cooperation Proclamation, one of their toolkits is ADR, and of course, you know, mediation falls under that. So I think as the parties get comfortable that, you know, and go beyond that 30% statistic you said that you were actually talking about ESI and the meet and confer, as we see more of that, we're going to see an increased need in having mediation to navigate the process.
Yeah,
I agree with you on that, Carl.
Although I would like to point out, and this comes right out of a recent podcast with Ralph Losey from a week and a half ago. We were talking about specialization versus generalists, and Ralph, who's as well known nationally as anyone as an e-discovery expert, said he has a hard time getting his arms around being an expert in the area because it's such a big space. And every day as an e-discovery expert, he runs into things he doesn't know about because it keeps changing, as does everyone, because it is there are things you know and then there are things you don't know, and that runs throughout this field.
Well, in my class today, we had the Vice President of Computer Technology Solutions just come and talk, and we were talking about cloud computing, and there was a recognition that pretty much every 6 months, whatever was the latest and greatest in technology is now passé, and there's something new. And you're going to have to stay on the cutting edge of what is going on. So I understand what Ralph is saying, but Peter, you might could address that.
Well,
staying current,
right? Yeah, I mean, I'd say part of that's true and part of it's not because. Just to really date myself, I got my master's in computer science in 1972, and computers really work the same way they used to. I mean, they're smaller, faster, and cheaper, and we have the internet that's available, but when it comes down to it, like today, one of the real hot things, and I think you mentioned this a minute ago, Carl, was dealing with cloud computing, where you're having the processing being done on the internet somewhere, you don't know where it is. Well, technically, it's really not very different than time sharing was back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But what happens a lot in the computer arena is old technologies get new labels. And trying to figure out how the new labels work, it's not always so easy because you have new software tools that use completely different labels that never existed before, and it makes it very confusing to figure that out because that isn't readily apparent. And now we're also in a mode which is kind of strange. Back in the 70s and 80s, there were a lot of mini computers, and then when Microsoft took off in the 80s, mid-80s, to be sort of the dominant server, that and Unix and Linux. But now we're back to this proprietary age where HP has some proprietary boxes that they sell, and Oracle just bought Sun, and so they're now having proprietary database machines that are completely unique, and so that means that an electronic discovery expert's going to have to understand how that works, which is different than the Microsoft server. I mean, it's just going to be a very unique thing. So there's technology never stops changing. I guess I agree with that.
I'll give you the most current issue, and I see this as one of the hottest ones this year, is Everyone's talking about new concept searching tools, yet, and that's the area I focus in, yet no one is talking really about how you use them in the litigation process effectively and building process. And it's an area where lawyers, where there's a continuing evolution. So there are we got lots of examples of where the field keeps changing and staying on top of both technology and law as challenges.
But the question that got us off on this, which is I think important, is having been a mediator for more than 20 years, my sense is we have a whole cadre of very skilled, trained mediators who are there to settle cases. That's the job.
Yeah.
And this changes that focus. And I like the way Allison said it, time versus issue based. And I really think that this requires a whole different thought process about what is this all about? Because my experience as a mediator and as a litigant is that generally the mediation is the first time the client is ever confronted with the reality of their case.
Okay. One of the questions I had is when you look at parties that are confused about e-discovery, you can see having a helping hand makes a lot of sense. But Allison, how about if you have a situation where you've got two parties that understand e-discovery? Is there a reason why they still might want to have a mediator?
Well, certainly, Carl, because even though they understand e-discovery doesn't mean they're going to agree on what they should be doing as they represent their client's best interest. And so you're still going to have disputes among the savviest of e-discovery lawyers. In fact, you may have more. So just because you're knowledgeable in e-discovery doesn't mean you're not going to have disputes and need some kind of resolution.
Yeah, and I think one of the advantages of this process, Carl, is that if you do have technically skilled lawyers, I think that's a real plus. But if you have the opportunity to present that to your client, maybe in-house counsel and the IT folks with the mediator, it probably will be a more efficient exercise.
I got a call from a lawyer in Chicago who had read my paper and said, thank you for offering this tool to us litigators, because when I go and talk to my client and say, we have all this responsibility and this duty to preserve and we've got to produce this and we've got to search this, they don't understand, and there's pushback pushback from the in-house folks to their outside counsel, and the mediation process can help both of them get focused together. The client is hearing it from a third-party neutral, and it just doesn't seem like a billing exercise coming from their own client. And so the mediation process can open that dialogue and communicate, what is the duty, what are we required to do, and how can we do it efficiently and effectively.
And that's the same reason, let me just add on to that because I think this is important. That's another reason why my view of the world and mediations is everybody is better served by the mediator being a lawyer, because they can challenge the parties to the reality of what's going to happen at trial and how this is going to play out, because there are mediators that are not lawyers out there too.
The other thing, Carl, I'd like to add, what I found in my own experience when I mediated discovery, I was called in on a case. We were about to face sanctions, have our affirmative defenses struck for failure to comply with discovery orders. And when I came into the case and we ended up mediating it, when I went back into the courtroom, all of a sudden I had gained so much credibility with the judge, with whom we had already lost so much credibility, because the judge was sick of the parties fighting, acting like children, I think, as we were described. And so when we were able to come in and say, we have mediated all these discovery disputes for almost a week, and we only have one or two issues that require the court's attention, the judge sat up and listened to us thoughtfully, and we really earned our respect back and gained our credibility. And that is one of those just invaluable things that a litigator needs to you know, hang on to in front of the court.
So a lot of ways this can be the glue to the whole cooperation proclamation, that you want to cooperate, but having someone in the middle decide what's the best path to cooperate to hit the goal of, you know, open disclosure and so that the case can be tried.
Exactly, Carl. You are right. Using the mediation process, I think, is a way to demonstrate your cooperative good faith efforts in trying to navigate the discovery in the case.
Well, you just mentioned an interesting example where things had gone wrong and a mediator was brought in. You know, I'm sort of curious, what's the mechanism or the light bulb, you know, switch that enables people to recognize that this might be helpful? I mean, is it education among litigators, or is it one party proposing it? What's the best way to have this discussion occur? Because it's got to happen at some point. It's an innovation.
Are you asking my situation or just generally?
Generally, what do you think? How does the mediation movement get pushed along in e-discovery?
Well, I think by having discussions like we're having here at ESI Bites, is just getting the information out and educating the bar that you've always had mediation in your toolkit, but now you can pull it out and use it for e-discovery. And I think it's a matter of communicating it, getting the word out, and educating the bar that this is something the process they're very familiar with, and it can be very helpful to them.
And as to follow up with that, Allison and I are doing a webcast for the State Bar of Texas on this exact same topic. So I think she's right. I think part of it is it's an awareness issue, because interestingly enough, mediations are accepted better and worse in different parts of the country. And so this isn't going to work everywhere, but those places where mediation is an embraced form of ADR, I think this has got a lot of prospect. And it's a rethinking of the fact that you have the mediation and you can use it for something other than just resolving the entire dispute. That's a little different all by itself.
You know, one of the areas where you might help with this is having, you know, ways to get people trained to become e-discovery mediators. And you've done some work in this area, Allison, and you've written something on this. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I wrote a paper called The Role of Mediation for ESI Disputes. You can find it at the Schrodinger Permit website. You can find it if you'll just Google my name, and on Peter's blog as well. Along with that paper, and then that was published by DRI. It was also published by the Alabama Lawyer and the a couple other publications. And then I followed that paper up with a paper on how to prepare an e-mediation statement. And I walk the litigants through what would you need to do to get prepared to have an e-mediation. What are some things that you need to provide to the mediator? What would the mediator need to know in advance in preparation of the mediation to help the parties create a mediated discovery plan, which Peter and I have been referring to as an MEP. And I think that would probably be helpful to the parties as well.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I mean, when Allison and I first met, I did a blog on her idea and called it Allison Skinner's Brilliant Idea, E-Mediation.
Thank you, Peter.
And, yeah, but no, the reason I'm bringing that up is that it got viral very quickly with the ADR community, and it was recognized as one of the top blogs of the month by Mediate.com. So I think that when people look at this, it goes, oh, that's a great idea. Every judge that I've discussed this with since I met Allison, immediately they say, God, that could have saved me so much aggravation in this case or that case. And it's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah. No, I mean, I can see some I can see where it can add value in the space where, you know, we're working with each other to get to the heart of the matter is the key of resolving e-discovery disputes and getting to the heart of litigation. If you don't, then you're just killing yourself fighting battles over ESI, which no one wants to do.
Allison just said she wrote these papers, but I will tell you that they are really outstanding, very straightforward, simple to follow, and the advice and putting together the e-mediation statement and what happens at the event, they're really well done and very clear. And I think most people involved in electronic discovery can read this. And there's no rocket science with this, but it's really laid out so simply and clearly. Very impressed with Allison's ability to make this so simple.
Well, I appreciate that, Peter. To go back, Carl, to your original question about finding these e-mediators, all I can say is maybe stay tuned. I think in 2010 we'll see some opportunities to get some mediators that are already trained in the mediation process trained in e-discovery. I think you'll see that as a trend.
Okay. So if I, you know, to make it personal, since everyone here is giving personal examples, you know, I've hosted 55 podcasts across all forms of e-discovery, and I'm a lawyer, and I'm also a technologist. Yeah, there might be a place where I could learn about this topic if I wanted to add e-mediation to my arsenal. Correct?
Yes, and also, Carl, do you have mediation training? Because most states require so many hours to be registered as a mediator in the state. Do you have that training, the underlying training?
I'm too steep in e-discovery.
Well,
it's never too late to become a mediator.
Well, just like we've talked about with the law schools recognizing that we have a convergence of the law and technology, here we have a convergence of e-discovery and mediation, and I think that the opportunity to be educated in becoming an e-discovery mediator might also offer at the front end the underlying training on how to become a mediator in the mediation process.
Yeah, and I think you're the perfect example, Carl, because if you had the opportunity to go through mediator training tomorrow, you could look at Allison's articles and you have a roadmap exactly how to do this. You wouldn't need a whole lot more.
Well, that sounds very, very interesting. I guess to go back to the original question or the original problem that I threw out there, which I'm not sure if it connects to that strongly, is the 70% issue. You know, all these cases with ESI involved in them that potentially could have ESI in them that people are opting out. Do you see a way that mediation can help? Help people deal with ESI, you know, more, I don't want to say honestly, but more proactively?
Well, Carl, absolutely. What I have seen is because there's a lack of knowledge, like you stated earlier, on e-discovery, then counsel goes into the meet and confer very skittish about how to respond and how to deal with it. And so if you can have written into your scheduling order that you will go to mediation, you have just helped that lawyer who may not feel comfortable in this arena yet because maybe this is their first case to deal with ESI or, you know, they've been putting it off, whatever the reason is. And it helps give the attorney, and I hate to put it this way, but helps them with their learning curve through the mediation process because they're going to have their client there. I recommend that you have an IT representative participate in the mediation. So all, you know, Ralph Losey in his book talks about e-discovery teams and the triangular relationship that we're going to all have to come together and work. In that mediation process, you have all those aspects coming together at one time. So I think that it will actually advance the learning curve for lawyers on how to navigate these issues.
Well, this has been very interesting. It seems like I'll chalk this area up to another, there's hope in the future, just like there's hope in more law schools teaching e-discovery and lawyers coming out, you know, from a technology generation getting involved in the field. I think mediation offers a lot of hope.
But we still have, there are an awful lot of gray hairs like me that are practicing law that just bury their heads in the sand and don't want to know anything about technology. And I agree with your comment you just made, Carl, that as more younger lawyers are technologically savvy, And they're the ones responsible for these lawsuits. I think that this will be a great vehicle, the e-mediation will be a great vehicle to help move litigation along. And it will help reduce, which is what Allison was saying, it will reduce the amount of motion practice, and the judges don't have to get very frustrated about the fact that the parties can't agree on anything. That's always the worst part that happens in court. The parties can't agree on anything. And they want the judge to decide. And so what does a judge do? Split the baby in half or arbitrarily decide something one way or the other? And that's not necessarily in the best interest of the parties, obviously.
Well, we'll keep an eye on this trend. Certainly we'll keep in touch. Peter, I'll see you at Legal Tech next week. And,
okay, look forward to it.
Look forward to seeing if this is a trend that offers a lot of promise in the future. I think it sounds encouraging. So,
well, Carl, thank you so much for having us today.
Yeah, thanks, Carl. Yeah. We really appreciate the opportunity to participate in the podcast today.
Thank you for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have people such as yourself share your knowledge with us and your listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do more shows with you later in the year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our shows. That's Easy Bytes, which is an easy way to remember the name of the show. Incidentally, that's also how I like the show to be perceived, as sort of easy bites of ESI information, more importantly, easily digestible, I guess I'd like to say. But however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Jurnov, wishing you a nice day.